No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's Glass Colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Marilia is not with us tonight because she's a little under the weather. We're hoping that she feels better out there, and she'll be back next week. I also want to mention that this week we saw Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah pass. He was the longest serving senator in the history of Utah. He was a Republican, but he stood with us on a thing called the D.C. Voting Rights Act. He tried to get the people of the District of Columbia a vote, and for that we will be forever grateful, and our condolences go out to him, his family, and his friends, and the people of the state of Utah. Tonight, we have a great guest. We have Derek Gray, who's been an archivist in the People's Archive at the District of Columbia Public Library since 2008. Mr. Gray has a special passion for the presentation, documentation, and preservation of African American experiences in Washington, D.C. We're here to, among other things, talk about his new book, The NAACP in Washington, D.C., From Jim Crow to Home Rule. And welcome to the show, Mr. Gray. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Pleasure to be with you tonight.
Well, and let me tell you, before we start, so that I can be totally transparent, I am married to a librarian who believes that the greatest people on the face of the planet are librarians. So let me just say that I already have great respect for you.
Thank you.
And we're happy to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And I've known a lot of librarians in my life. You know, my wife was in charge of all D.C. public school libraries at one time. And so I've met tons of librarians in my life. She taught at Catholic University, taught library science. And anyway, you're great people. You're really
interesting
people.
Librarians and archivists are wonderful.
And archivists,
Yes,
I know they're different. But the one thing I think that all of you share is a great curiosity about things, you know. I mean, don't ask my wife a question that you don't want the answer to. You know, if you're
watching a movie
and you go, what else has she been in? You can bet you're going to get her whole resume in about 30 seconds. But anyway, let's talk first about your new book. Tell us about your new book and why you think it's important and what does it have to say?
Okay, well, my book is, I really have to say that I pretty much thank the many people who have come through the doors of the D.C. Public Library. We were the Washingtonian Division, but now, since we're in the new building, we have a new name, the People's Archive. And I've been with the library since 2008, and many people came through the doors looking, seeking information on local civil rights activism in the city, grad students, undergrads, authors, scholars, everybody and anybody. And I have to say that, you know, people come into the library thinking that the person behind the desk has all the information, but I've discovered that you can learn just as much from the person who is coming in when you're behind the desk. So it's a two-way street. So I was pretty much inspired by those folks because I was thinking about something that we don't have. We don't have the records of the NAACP in our collection. We have a lot of wonderful other resources, but we don't have those records. So that kind of just piqued my interest. Often we think about, you know, we automatically, when we hear, you know, hear about the Civil Rights Movement, we always automatically think of the 50s and the 60s and the South. But, you know, obviously, you know, it began much earlier than that time period. So in terms of the NAACP, knowing that the district was, you know, was segregated Jim Crow City, I just became very interested in what was going on in D.C. in terms of its work. I wanted to know who were its major players, when was it founded, what were its victories, what were its defeats, and so forth. So that's what really got me interested in the book. And basically the book is about its founding in March of 1912, all the way to the up to 1972-73 with the passage of home rule in the district. So it was a lot to cover in those 61 years, but it's an important story because there's a lot of work done on the organization nationally, but the branches in states and whatever are very fascinating because of their unique challenges and so forth. So the D.C. branch was the fourth largest. No, I'm sorry. It was the fourth branch to form after New York, Boston, and Chicago, and it bore the unique distinction that it was pretty much the first all-black branch. Because the NAACP, when it was founded in 1909, it was primarily founded by and run by white progressives. I mean, it was a coalition of black and white, but in terms of its administration, most of its leaders were white progressives. And those first three branches were predominantly white. And the D.C. branch was the first branch to be all African-American, pretty much. And also, it bore the unique responsibility of playing two roles. It was the NAACP's representative in D.C., and it was to monitor legislation being passed in Congress, particularly a lot of legislation that would negatively impact African Americans. And it was also the organization that would look out for the interests of black communities in D.C.
Well, let me ask you, what is it that you found that surprised you? What's one thing that surprised you that you didn't expect to find when you did your research?
That's a good question. What shocked me the most was pretty much what came to be the main argument of the book, or the main topic theme. What would the what kind of a branch would it be? And I discovered that there was basically the branch jockeyed back and forth or oscillated back and forth between accepting being accepted by the white establishment versus being a more militant organization. And throughout the years covered in the book, it went back and forth. Sometimes it was, there was moderate to conservative leadership, and then there was more radical militant action. So that was what really surprised me. And what I argue is that I bookend the book in terms of the when it first organized in D.C., it was dismissed, not by just white leaders and the white press, but also the African American press, and that was attributed to because of a man named William Calvin Chase, who was the editor of the Washington Bee and was quite a firebrand on racism. And he just basically argued that, well, these movements that bring together black and white just don't work. He just thought it was just another movement that just would not thrive. He had gone back to other movements like the Equality League and W.E.B. Du Bois Niagara movement, and he was a harsh critic of Du Bois, and he said, this is just not going to work. Blacks need to obtain civil rights and freedom on their own. So he dismissed it for a whole year. So again, going back to the book ending, when you get into the 60s, that's exactly what the folks who were, the Black Power movement was beginning to elevate its voice in D.C. by that time. And you had all these other competing organizations, like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Congress of Racial Equality and the Black United Front and Julius Hobson's Association of Community Teams, all of these, and SNCC, all of these organizations were saying, this is, the NAACP's brand of leadership was not working. And that's how a lot of Black Washingtonians felt by the 60s. So what Chase said in 1910 is what what the Black militants and radicals were saying in the 60s. But before you get to that point, the branch was the major civil rights organization in the city, and it was the leading organization in the city. So really up until the 50s, it was instrumental in toppling segregation in housing and education and law enforcement. But by the time you get to the 60s, it had waned.
Well, that was a primary criticism during the civil rights movement in the 60s, right? I remember a lot of people came after Martin Luther King. There was that division of the kind of Malcolm X approach,
exactly,
by any means necessary, and Dr. King's approach that if you lose your soul, it really doesn't matter. So there's always been that tension. And something that I found very interesting, and I wonder if you could give me your take on this, but in a book written by Kate Mazur called An Example for All the land, where she talks about the beginning of Washington. Washington, and which was run by the Republicans in those days, was on the one hand pretty liberal about things like African Americans starting their own social clubs and work related things, but they really set forth a policy of segregation, which ended up being the rule of the land for many, many years, did it not?
Yeah, and you know, in D.C., I talk about this, like the branch's formation followed in a long line of activism, and I go back to the Plessy versus Ferguson decision in 1896. Ushered in by the Supreme Court, separate but equal. And, you know, you had the National Association of Colored Women, the Colored Women's League, and the Niagara Movement. And those, the Colored Women's League and the Colored Women's Clubs, these activists, African American women, made up the bulk of, you know, the civil rights activism way before the branch came into existence. And again, because of Plessy, they had a lot of meetings, like at the 19th Street Baptist Church, for example, and folks like Mary Church Terrell and Anna Julia Cooper, who were leaders in those organizations. So, and also they were also active in Du Bois' Niagara Movement. The Niagara Movement had members in 21 states and D.C. And a lot of these folks who were part of these early organizations later formed the branch.
Well, it's one thing that's always been frustrating to me as somebody that advocates for the rights of D.C. residents is that we did play such an important role throughout history in everything from, you know, one of the plaintiffs in Brown versus Board of Education was from D.C. Of course, the Dr. King's famous speech was given on the Mall here. The March on Washington was a seminal moment in the civil rights movement. There's been a lot of civil rights stuff that's gone on here in the District of Columbia for people that still don't have equal rights. I mean, it's somewhat frustrating. I don't think a lot of people realize that. Let me ask you about the focus of the NAACP. One of my problems in Washington in getting people involved in fighting for their own civil rights here, because we don't have representation, is the fact that we focus more on national issues than we do local issues here in the district. The people in power in the district can tell you more about Hillary Clinton than they can about Muriel Bowser. They focus on national issues so much more, or tell you more about Donald Trump than they can tell you about somebody like Julius Hobson, who was one of my heroes and a real leader. What do you think about the NAACP? Did we lose something because they had to focus on the national, or did they focus also on local from that time, from that Jim Crow?
That's a good question. So, again, that's what... That's what made it so important and made it so challenging for the branch, because, you know, it was serving two constituencies, if you will. I mean, you know, pretty much the nation again, you know, because when the when the branch formed, it was formed in March of 1912, and that was the year that Woodrow Wilson was elected President of the United States. And, you know, maybe about a couple of months before, you know, Wilson is elected, there were some leadership issues with the branch. And there was a man, Archibald Grimke, who came in later and was installed after John Milton Waldron, pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church, who was a great civil rights leader. He had an impeccable civil rights resume. I mean, he was treasurer of the Niagara Movement. He was fought for civil rights in Florida. He formed the Alley Improvement Association in Washington, and which helped poor African Americans in squalid alley dwellings. So he was really you know, significant. But he due to some issues he was ousted, and Grimke came in, and the issue, so the biggest issue facing the branch was what was the issue that needed to really galvanize the branch. And that's when Wilson comes in, and who, as we all know, along with his cabinet, proceeded to segregate the federal government, and which was very detrimental to Black Washingtonians and so forth. So that and the branch, so the branch now had an issue to fight for. I mean, they called it the new slavery, and they were like, no, this is not going to. We're not going to allow this. We're not going to let it stand. And so they coordinated a very well-developed strategy with the national office to launch this campaign against the Wilson administration in these segregation policies. I mean, it was just absolutely well-coordinated. I mean, the branch members and Grimke would go right up to Capitol Hill and in hearings and talk about what was going on, and encouraged Black workers to report what was going on. And so it was and at the same time you had these folks in Congress who were also calling for segregation in the government. So it wasn't just Wilson and you know, the Treasury Secretary and the Postmaster General, but it was also, you know, members of Congress. They were passing bills, allowing for segregation, segregated streetcars, and anti-intermarriage laws. So again, they're affecting Black people all over the country, but also Black residents of the district. So it's that local and national. And then also, as you get on into the 1920s and 30s, they're taking on lynching and police brutality. So although there weren't, like, lynchings in D.C., the branch was arguing, well, you know, police brutality is akin to lynching. So what's going on in Mississippi and Texas, that's the same thing. That same type of white violence is going on in the district. So again, the national was and the local were pretty much the same. So and no other branch was facing this challenge. So, you know, no other branch, you know, the foe, the enemy, if you will, was not the President of the United States, but in D.C., that's what was going on. And again, all eyes were on the branch. I mean, you can go into the records and see where people are writing to the branch from all over, like, what are you going to do? Or here's what you need to do in D.C. Look out for us, because what happens in D.C. is, you know, is going to affect us in Ohio and you know, Mississippi or Texas or Georgia.
Well, I've argued for a long time that they should teach a course on this in D.C. You know, there should be a course on the statehood movement, our attempt to get equal rights in the District of Columbia in D.C. colleges, because it's a great, it's not only a great look at a civil rights struggle, but it really is a great look at American history. There's so much that went on here in the District of Columbia, from court cases to protests to just the sort of thing that you're talking about, that, you know, I think there's so much to be learned. We started a website called Teach Democracy, which does just that. We try to showcase how Washington history is American history. But let me ask you, is there an ebb and flow that you found with the NAACP in terms of their popularity? I think now about groups that have come forth, several of whom we've had on the show, like Black Lives Matter and Color of Change. They seem to be, you know, again, pushing an agenda that seems more radical than the traditional NAACP, or more, and I shouldn't say more radical, more aggressive than the typical NAACP agenda. Do you find that the popularity of the organization kind of ebbs and flows in its history?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's going back to one of the main arguments in the book. That's exactly what I found. You know, it was when it first was formed in D.C. It was really the major civil rights organization, so it was the only one. But then there was another group, for example, like the National Race Congress that formed, and where its leaders were arguing that, you know, you're not representing or reaching out, or you're not connecting with all Black Washingtonians, and that's where class comes into play. And that was one thing that really came out in my research, is, you know, because it was founded by the Black elite in D.C., and a lot of the criticisms that later came were that, you know, it really did not connect with the working poor, the working class or the poor in the city, whereas these other groups took up those issues. So the popularity did ebb and flow, because by the 30s, you do start seeing more aggressive, militant or radical, whatever term you want to use, organizations that are basically competing with the NAACP in D.C., like the New Negro Alliance. Whereas the argument is, what vehicle of activism do you use? Because the branch was always comfortable with legal proceedings. You know, we'll go through the courts, we'll go through petitioning, and, you know, meeting in office boardrooms and you know, that type of a thing. Not demonstrations, not picketing, not more street action, if you will, not getting out there and really marching and protesting. And some of those defeats were called out by some of these organizations because of that, as an example of that. And again, when you get to the 60s, where I pretty much end, you know, this new wave of leaders that come about, like Judith Hobson and Marion Barry, that they're offering the leadership that Black Washingtonians want to see. They have the appetite for, you know, radicals and militants. It was at by this point you're seeing that the popularity has declined because the activism and the leadership is seen by many as, well, it's too tepid, it's too moderate. It's just and you see that with you know that I think that's you see that currently where, you know, Black Lives Matter and some of these other groups are saying that, you know, the NAACP's leadership might be a little too traditional, and that's when what's interesting is that the leaders that were a little bit more radical, if you will, they had they had launched their careers. They had their beginnings in the branch. Like Hobson was a member of the branch first before he left and became a member of CORE, and then he left CORE and became a member of the Association of Community Teams, which was pretty much a Black Power organization. So it's just really interesting that these leaders were where they got their start. So in a sense, the almost like the branch trained them to be, what they ended up becoming.
Well, let me ask you, because this has become an issue today. There are two Republican congressmen in the current Congress that have introduced legislation to remove home rule in the District of Columbia, to get rid of home rule. How instrumental was the NAACP in making home rule happen? And by the way, our friend Julius Hobson used to call it home fool because he didn't believe it really was self-determination, since we're still controlled by Congress. But how instrumental was the NAACP in bringing that about?
Well, I did find that for a long time, the branch's focus was segregation, and it wasn't home rule. Mm-hmm. And that was something that Marion Barry noticed when he came to D.C. in 1965. And I'm sure you're familiar with the Free D.C. movement that he launched, and along with the D.C. Coalition of Conscience. And that was something that, at first, Barry was able to unite a whole bunch of different groups around. But this was a perfect example of the perception that boycotts and was antagonistic to certain groups, and that's exactly what happened with Free DC movement. Barry threatened economic boycotts for, you know, these white businesses that did not support the Free DC movement, and the branch pulled out of that. They withdrew their support. They said that was the wrong way to go. That was extortion. That was blackmail, if you will. It's like you don't get to your goal by following that route. And so, although the Free DC movement did not bring about home rule to D.C., that was just a very a pivotal moment where I think, particularly in the 60s, where the branch was seen by Washingtonians as being somewhat ineffective on that front. And that's where, you know, so it's important to note the difference. Again, you know, legal segregation, you know, that they were instrumental in that. And I just want to keep going back to that in terms of toppling that. But then in the 60s, it's a new fight. You know, it's political inequality, social inequality. And that's where these other groups were seen as more effective in showcasing that. Because even King, when he comes to D.C., in 65, he acknowledges that importance. You know, he had, for the March on Washington, it was you know, civil rights and jobs and freedom, but he comes back in 65 and starts talking about home rule and its importance of home rule, and his connection to the branch, for him to kind of be talking about it more than what the branch was doing, was just a very, very interesting discovery.
I bet. And, you know, I find it so ironic that, you know, in 1953, the Supreme Court decided to there couldn't be something known as separate but equal. It was impossible to be separate but equal, but yet the District of Columbia is, you know, Congress still sees us as separate but equal. We're different than everybody else, but they argue that we're equal. Let me ask you, let me change gears a little bit, because I've always been fascinated by this. You were the co-author of a book called Angels of Deliverance, which talked about the Underground Railroad. There was a lot of activity in this area, was there not? I don't know about D.C., but of course Harriet Tubman was from Maryland. Is that right? And the railroad went through Maryland. Did it also go through D.C.?
I'm not sure. I'm not. Yeah, I'm. That's. I really can't answer. I'm not the one to really talk to about that period. Okay. I am, as a native of New York, you know, in Long Island, that's what that other book focused on. And I was one of four co-authors, yeah. So I just did one little chapter. But I can't. There's other folks that could better answer the Underground Railroad in D.C. than me.
Okay. I still have family on Long Island.
Really? Where?
Southampton.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
A place where I could never afford to live.
Yeah.
You know, my mother's family, I'm from Newark, New Jersey. Uh-huh. And my mother's family emigrated to Southampton, where they were maids in the big fancy houses out there. Uh-huh. And my father used to say, only your mother's family would have emigrated from Southampton to Newark. And if you've ever been to Newark, you would understand why he said that. It was quite a bit.
Yeah. I never. That's one part of the island, because I'm from Uniondale, Nassau County. Uh-huh. I never got out that way.
No, we used to go visit our fancy relatives, and I remember as a child having to take out my best clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we wouldn't be embarrassed when we went out from Newark. What is there anything that I haven't asked? The show's getting on in time now. We have about 15 minutes left. But is there anything that you want to talk about from the book that we haven't talked about?
No, I think we're doing great.
Good.
But I just wanted to say that that, you know, this history is very important in that, again, going back to the whole, you know, and I just think it's an unfortunate myth, if you will, in our society about like when, why, how we tend to focus on a certain time period in terms of the civil rights movement, and also where, you know, that it was just in the South. You know, it was national. I was talking with someone back home who's looking at doing some work on, you know, the civil rights movement in New York and on Long Island, you know, that type of a thing. So just to emphasize that, you know, that D.C. has a very important story, and we've talked about this, and you were absolutely right. You know, it's the local that fascinates me, particularly because, you know, I'll admit, you know, growing up, you know, I just thought D.C. was, you know, it was monuments and memorials and the White House. But, you know, since I've been with the library, and this is because, you know, the People's Archive is our local D.C. History Center, you know, it's really just, I can't emphasize enough just how rich the local history of Washington, D.C. is. And I just hope that this book contributes to that a little bit.
Well, let me ask you about the new library, which was a big controversy in Washington for a long time. Some people wanted to renovate it, and some people wanted to tear it down and rebuild it. Now, I got to be honest that I was never one of the people that saw any, you know, beauty in the building as it existed. I know that it was designed originally by some famous architect, and, you know, there were a lot of historical preservation people who wanted to keep the basic form of basic shape of the library. But the question I have for you is, while the library before the renovation, you needed a private detective to find the Washingtonia collection. You couldn't, you know, it wasn't something that was relatively accessible. It wasn't out in the open. You had to go in there looking for it. What about it now? Is it the same thing? Does it only seem acceptable or available to researchers and people that want to know about D.C., or can the general public walk in there?
I'm gonna push back a little bit on that. It's always been open and accessible because it's in a, you know, within, that's one of the that's the advantage of it being in, you know, in a public library. So we're on the fourth floor of the library. It's open. We welcome walk-ins. We do also make research appointments so we can pull items ahead of time for you. But it's completely accessible. You can walk in, and there's someone at the desk right there to assist you, and we're glad to help you with any questions you have.
What about, have you seen the Washington Historical Society? Have you been over to their building, which is the old Carnegie Library? Have you seen what they've done over there?
Yes, I have been over there. Yes.
And it's really cool, is it not? I mean, the first time. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we could do that at the library where it just like made, even if it was only on occasion, made that collection kind of the centerpiece, highlighted it, where we reach out to the community and try to draw them in? Because I think it does have an amazing history. Are we trying to do things like that?
I don't want to comment on that.
Okay. I think
Yeah.
I would like to see more of that,
You might want to
because
talk with administrators of both, and I don't, I'm not going to comment on that.
I would love to raise some money through the DC government to do more of that, because I think that people are really amazed at the extraordinary history of Washington, D.C., and they don't know about it locally. You say that, when growing up on Long Island, you thought it was monuments, and I think most people in Washington feel that too. They really don't understand the history of the District of Columbia. First of all, we have a very transient population, so there are a lot of people like me that weren't born here but spent their lives here. And I don't think that most Washingtonians really understand the history that's gone on here beyond the national events. I mean, we all know about the March on Washington. We all know about, Supreme Court decisions and things like that. But locally, I don't think a lot of people know who Julius Hobson is. I don't think people understand that Marion Barry was a civil rights leader before he came to Washington. I don't think that.
And that's I'm yeah that's that might be true, and I think that that's all the more reason why these institutions like the library and the People's Archive a lot of the other institutions around DC are so important to tell that story, because we're all telling that story, and we're there and we're available, and there's wonderful resources all over that tell that narrative, and I would just encourage your listeners to check out those places.
So let's talk about that for a minute. How do we interface with the Washingtonian collection? Can we get stuff Washingtonian collection? Can we get stuff online? Is there a way to connect with you online?
Yes, you go to it's dclibrary.org, and you'll see the People's Archive link in the banner, and you can call us, you can email us with a question or call us. Again, we are located on the fourth floor of the new building, and we also have there's a permanent exhibition in the building that is centered around Dr. King's legacy, since the building is named after him. So that's also another way to invite people in. You can check out the exhibit. It spans the entire floor, and you can come on in. But yes, we do, and some of our we do have kind of like an archives catalog on our website, so you can search for collections to see what we have, and we also do have some digitized material on our website. It's called Dig DC, and it's basically a collection of some digitized portions of collections and some born digital materials as well. So we do have an online presence.
And if I want to buy your book, how do I do that? Tell our listeners how to buy your book.
Oh yes, it's available at any online bookseller. I would encourage listeners to please support black businesses, black bookstores, so Mahogany Books, Loyalty Books. It's available there, and of course the Arcadia website, or Amazon. So it's available in many places. And
What do you see? Any prediction? I know that your analysis covers from the founding of the organization until the until home rule in the 1970s. But do you have any sense of the future of the NAACP? Do you see it still as a relevant organization that has a place in America among some more, let's call them, progressive groups?
Yeah, I do. I do. Because it is the, you know, it is the nation's oldest civil rights organization and has a wonderful, rich history to it. And I do, I have heard that question before, you know, by all types of people. You know, is it this question of, you know, is it still, quote unquote, relevant? And I think it is. Along with some of these other organizations that have emerged, you know, the Black community is very diverse. So, you know, what I think it's on the person to decide what type of organization they support and what works for them. But yes, I do see it. It's still relevant today, and it always will be, in my opinion.
And it also, correct me if I'm wrong, gives us great context on the experience of African Americans in America, and especially in Washington D.C.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a believer that past is prologue, so we learn so much from history. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Derek Ray, let me thank you so much for being with us and educating us a little bit about the NAACP, an important organization in our country. I hope that people will look into your book, The NAACP in Washington, D.C., From Jim Crow to Home Rule. It's the publisher is American Heritage. Get this
no, it's Arcadia. Arcadia.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have that's American Heritage. Yeah. But wrong. We're going to fire that research person. Arcadia Publishers. And thanks so much for being with us. And at the end
thank
of the
thank you, Senator Brown. Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Yeah, and at the end of the show, we always dedicate a song. So here's one to you, Derek, for your hard work. This is more of a modern civil rights song. This is John Mayer. Waiting on the World to Change. We'll see y'all next week.
All right.
Thanks
Thank
for helping
you.
Us.
Give the people their right to vote.